other yak babies. Sex, presidents, and sometimes books.
Welcome to Yak Babies, the only podcast on the internet sponsored by Randy Narwhal's Beer Hall. Come see our narwhal. My name's Aaron. I'm here with my personal pals, Dave.
Hey, boys.
Brick.
Hey, boys.
And calling from overseas, old Irish Nico.
Hey, boys.
This is a monumental episode in Yak Babies lore or Yak Babies canon. I'll give you some of the backstory here in case you haven't been listening to the whole series. This started back in, we first started recording Yak Babies. We did an episode about Philip Roth's death when he died. And in that episode discussed that Goodbye Columbus was one of my favorite books. And Dave, I believe you were surprised by that because I hadn't mentioned it before or something along those lines. It seemed like new information. And then you said you'd go read it, and you did, and then came back a couple months later, whenever it was, and you said you hated it, and you said that I was dumb and also an idiot, which was brutal. Then it became a thread for a while in the episodes. It became the basis for discussion of what happens when you recommend books to someone else and they don't like them and the consequences of that. And it sort of burbled on the surface for several episodes or so. So we thought might as well. And then, Brick, you read it recently, and we'll talk about that later. And then we figured we might as well do an episode about this book because we'd almost all read it. So this is it. This is the big episode. This is the coming to terms with Goodbye Columbus. What does it mean? What do we think? Hash it out. Have a fist fight. You know, rupture some friendships, that kind of thing. Maybe even exhume Philip Roth's body and do some investigations there. Who knows what will happen in this episode? Lots of stuff will happen, probably.
It was more like it wasn't what I was expecting, so I think part of it was my fault. I definitely did not know. I think in that episode you mentioned that he was your favorite writer, which is what I did not know at all. Like, I didn't know you were a Roth fan, much less that he was your favorite writer. So you mentioned Goodbye Columbus, and I said I'd never read any of his, so I read it, but I think I read it in the context of talking about Dybbuk and kind of knowing what you get out of Dybbuk. So I was, and you also said that Goodbye Columbus is partly set in Boston. So I was looking for something Stuart Dybbuk-like, you know, a lot of like sentimentality, I guess. And that's definitely not what I, what I found here.
But first, so Nico, you read the book, right? You read it?
Yeah, I read it.
Okay, so let's get the scorecard. So I obviously am pro. Dave, you were anti last time. We'll see what your new review is this time, but you were anti last time. Brick, I believe you were pro-ish last time, correct?
Pro.
And then Nico.
I was really disappointed that your audio got ruined from my old bait and switch. It's it's all right.
So on the spectrum, it sounds like I like it the most. Brick, maybe you're below me. Nico, you're next.
I'd say I'm mostly pro.
And then Dave, what about you?
I really enjoyed it the second time, knowing more about what I was getting into and just reading it for itself rather than reading it for what I thought it was going to be. But mostly, I feel like if I read it a second time and still didn't like it, then Aaron and I could no longer be friends. And, you know, our friendship is one thing, but if you and I became like bitter enemies over Philip Roth, I could see this podcast ending. And I think it's important.
Or getting better.
So I want to get your thoughts on this read-through then. Dave, this is your second read-through, and then Nico, your first, and Brick, your first too. I wanted to see if there's anything that stood out to you, anything that jumps out as interesting or provocative or things that stood out to you in your sort of returns to this book.
Yeah, he reminded me a lot of Richard Ford. You guys ever read Richard Ford? He wrote like literary suburban novels about like people in New Jersey. Not much happens, but like, you know, the writing is pretty good. He won the Pulitzer for one of his books that's just literally about, he had a series that was like about a real estate agent in New Jersey who starts off as a sports writer and then he just becomes a real estate agent, and it's like a holiday weekend. It's just like his thoughts about living in New Jersey, and he writes somehow for like 20 pages on why he likes living in this New Jersey suburb, and it's like pretty good, which I think is extremely hard to do. There's not many writers that can do that, but this reminded me a lot of that, because there's not the right, like, I like the writing, and then you kind of get to the end and you're like, what was that? You know, it's like, not, you know, very little happens. But it is enjoyable.
I think quite a bit happened, but it didn't happen for the main character. I think this book is really about Brenda, and she's in a very different place at the end of this summer than she is in the beginning. I think, you know, I think largely this is, I don't know if calling it feminist is the right way to describe it, but I mean, this is a book about a turning point in American culture, I think, for a lot of different maybe groups or demographics. And I think on the surface, you know, it's about the decline or the change in masculinity, as well as maybe some of the socioeconomic attachments to being white male in America, and how he kind of comes up against that and doesn't really have the privilege he maybe hoped to assume or her family thought he would. But we also see Brenda making kind of the mental steps towards her own independence from the expectations and kind of almost bondage of her family, right? They're really nice, but they feel she needs to be a certain way. And ultimately her decision with the diaphragm and more is not actually about him. I think it starts that way into sort of fitting the molds, but it ends up being, you know, the first steps of her liberation.
So she's starting her journey into being like a sexual being, like an independent sort of sexual being and person by showing her the diaphragm, basically. Right.
Yeah. And I don't think it's just about her sexuality, but I think that's the kind of the opening salvo, right? Like her decision around that leads to her feeling that she doesn't need to necessarily define herself around this family role.
We're thinking she leaves the diaphragm on purpose. Does that ever become clear, or
it kind of seems like she did, but also I think the decision to get one is probably more important than the decision to let it be found.
Well, I don't know. The decision to get one is one thing. The decision to leave it in her sock drawer so her mom will find it seems like a kind of a bigger thing, if what we're talking about is her liberation from her family.
Maybe, but I think even if the second step is a bigger step, the first step is often more important.
Yeah, the text doesn't give us that confirmation. It's, you know, because the text is all in Neil's head, that we're taking his version of events, so he believes that she did it intentionally, so therefore we do. We're not exactly sure what, but certainly it seems like Brenda, the way she responds to what Neil says, does believe or does side with her family in some way. She's getting what she wants, which is getting rid of him, right? Whether she wants to be the good daughter or not anymore, she's siding with the version of events where she is sort of now having to reject him in some way.
Yeah, his insecurities around her family's money largely kind of caused him to act like an asshole, but within the expectations of their culture, right? But there's other parts of the book where she's not in it, where we see him step out, like particularly the thing with the black kid in the library. He goes way outside the expectations of his culture in how he handles and thinks of that situation. So to have those work against each other, and to see, you know, when it comes to race, he's almost forward thinking, but then he, maybe out of cowardice, maybe I don't know, he falls into these patterns with her. That, I mean, the relationship's doomed the second he makes that call, right? But she goes along with it.
What call specifically? Because it's been a little while since I read it. So
he wants her to get a diaphragm so they can have premarital sex, basically, right?
Well, is that how you guys read it? Yeah, I thought they were having sex and he wanted to have sex without a condom.
That's what I mean. Like, he wanted to. But that was like in the bounds of their. I mean, that's a husband and wifely thing. That you know, it's a pre birth control ubiquity situation. So that was he was sort of making a husbandly decision for her as the woman without going through the commitment steps ahead of time. So he was sort of asking her for an illegitimate relationship, particularly in the eyes of her family, which there's very clear expectations of what that family wanted.
So you think, is that, so I had a bit of a problem because...
I'm also not convinced they were having sex. I think they were together, but it didn't sound like it was sex. But I could be wrong.
He said that thing about... So I was trying to, I think part of it is like, this is kind of a time capsule in a lot of ways, like the way like sex ed was in the, what is it, 50s? And the way people went about it. Like, I feel like when it was published, all of this shit would be clear, but like, I don't think it's not very clear to me exactly what they're talking. You know, it's almost like you watch like an episode of Seinfeld now, like I don't feel like like a 20-year-old kid now would understand a lot of Seinfeld, but anyway, so I looked up a little bit about like what sex ed was like, and because for one thing, I wasn't even sure if there were, like, if like condoms were widely distributed, were they used, and it turned out that they were. And they were actually, the army would show people in the army propaganda films to make them wear condoms. And I think he was in the army, right? He was for a bit. So my guess is that the way I read it was that he used condoms. He had probably had sex in the army and then came back and wanted her to use a diaphragm instead. It just seems kind of asshole-ish, like, because she's so uncomfortable with it. And he's like one of those guys that's like, I can't with the condom. Like, it's just not the same, which I don't understand. I guess how did you, Dave and Aaron, read that diaphragm condom thing?
You know, I think it also stands in for this larger, I mean, the diaphragm is about him wanting to have sex with the condom, but it also stands in for this larger conversation that Roth and Neil, I guess, are having in the book about modernity and what it means to grow up or not, and to take on the role of a sexually active person, but also to be a husband. It all seems to be kind of wrapped up in questions of assimilation too. You know, do you want to get married and become part of the family, have kids, get a job at the family company, you know, or do you want to reject that? And the sort of diaphragm is asking Neil to, you know, he says he's a carnal person. He obviously wants to, it's about his pleasure. He wants to have sex, but he has that prayer section when he's waiting for Brenda, where he talks about he's a carnal person, but what's the limits of carnality? You know, how much can he take? Not how much can he endure, but how much can he physically take in terms of like sexual pleasure? So it seems that it's on this pivot point. The diaphragm represents commitment, but also represents like kind of pure sexual id. And how much does Neil want to give up one to become one or the other? That's the question of assimilation too. And I think that he seems to actively hate it, the idea of assimilation, but also in some ways craves it, or at least wants it towards the end of what he's saying.
Yeah, it kind of makes you wonder if he asks her to get a diaphragm thinking that she won't and that it'll be the ruin of their relationship, because he sees this path being laid out before him where he's going to end up with this company and it's like what he feels is expected of him, or the kind of thing that's expected of him, but he kind of wants to rebel against that too, at least in this subtler way. But then she does it and he's like, whoa, wait, what?
Yeah, I think so. She needs a man. She needs a husband to get the diaphragm, right? So, it seems almost like he's in his way, and I don't think he's going about this very well. It seems like he's trying to get her to commit to him without him committing to her family. He wants to probably be with her and not the rest of the clan, but he also doesn't know her well enough, right? And that's part of it, is you meet someone, you date them for 2 weeks in the 1950s, and then you have to marry them forever. And that was the expectation. And then why I think this kind of ends up being Brenda's story is she largely comes to the same decision, but she doesn't want him, right? So she seems like she kind of wants out of her family, and not in a, I want to estrange myself from them, not be a part of them, but like, I need to stop being the daughter and I need to go be a woman and I want to go to college and I want to live my thing. And then Neil ends up being the vehicle for that, right? So she takes him up on his offer, and then, but you know, he didn't put a ring on it. So just a diaphragm.
Yeah, I think he wants a little of everything. He wants to be able to fuck her, but he also wants to be in a relationship that's more committed. He wants to be part of his family, but also wants to get rid of them and sort of aspires to a more comfortable life in Short Hills. You know, he's sort of stuck. He wants all those things in some way. She doesn't want to marry him either, right? I think she sees Neil as a form of acting out, as a rebellion of some kind. But I don't think she sees him as a long-term partner with that potential. At least maybe doesn't ultimately conclude that at the end of the novel. We see even in the letters that the parents, that her mom and dad write. Her mom's letter says something about how, you know, they indulged her choice for the summer, but you know, everyone knew it was just like it's kind of like a scam or whatever you want to call it. And her dad says something about how he never said anything bad about her friends before. This was her one exception, like the exception that proves the rule, or something along those lines. I think that Brenda is on that same path. Like she agrees with them in some ways.
Yeah, but I also think she's feeling her way through it, right? I think this is the pattern these two are in is now kind of an accepted pattern of how teenagers in America and probably most of the world, their pattern of rebellion against their parents, right? Whereas that was just not, you either were in or you were out prior, right? And now there's an acceptance that you're gonna push back, and then you're gonna be welcome back. And I think we see Brenda poking at that. I don't think she wanted to marry Neil ever, but I do think she actually considered it. I don't think she was lying, but I think she ultimately realized that doing the thing with the diaphragm and having the relationship with him was opening the door for her independence. And it took stepping through that door to realize that even though she was thinking she wanted to marry him, she didn't actually. And that's where she ends up at that conversation in the hotel room. Thanks for the trip, but I'm going to go the rest of the way on my own.
So Dave, we mentioned before that you, when you first read this, you were looking for more of a Dibbitt kind of thing and didn't get that. That kind of maybe was part of your negative reaction. And one of the things that we talk about with Dibbitt is that wistfulness, that sort of sense of nostalgia, sweetness. And one thing I don't get from Dibbitt really, that I do get from Goodbye Columbus and from Roth in general, is humor. This is a really funny novel. It's a sharp humor. It's not a very nice humor. It's pretty mean. The stuff with Ron especially is really funny. It's not very nice. It kind of paints Ron as a sort of dopey figure. But some of the lines are pretty good. Roth can really get over a turn of phrase in a comic way. The rest of you sort of have that same reaction. Do you find this book funny at all? Did it hit for you?
Yeah, definitely. Especially those scenes you're talking about with Ron, particularly the one where they listen to the record together, the OSU record together. But also every one of his conversations with his aunt, Neil's conversations with his aunt, make me laugh. Man, those are just brilliant.
Yeah, it's a sharp humor, right? It's not, like I said, it's not very nice. It's cutting. It's not angry, but it's cutting in a way that I think makes you, maybe, or makes me feel a little bit uncomfortable in some ways. But it is still funny. I still laugh quite a bit. So it's not that uncomfortable. But it is certainly a very specific kind of humor.
Do you get that in all of his books?
Yeah, Portnoy's Complaint is a comic novel, for sure. And it's there in a lot of his work, I think. Things like The Human Stain, the Nathan Zuckerman novels, The Ghostwriter, that those kind of novels don't have as much of it, I don't believe. But certainly, it's there. He did write a satirical novel about Nixon called Our Gang, I believe, that was not that good. It wasn't very funny. At least I don't remember it being very funny. Maybe it is, but I sincerely doubt it. I think that Roth would view himself as a funny writer, and that humor is an important part of the way he would approach his characters and voices. Whether it always works is a different question. So I want to talk a little bit about the line that I think to me is emblematic of why I love this novel so much. It's on page 120 of my edition. This is towards the end, after Brenda has gone back to Radcliffe, and it's the fall, summer is over, and they're sort of, or Neil is back in his routine. And he's thinking about the library and the kid who was coming this summer, who's disappeared now, and he wonders what happened to him, and so on. And there's this line after the paragraph break. It says this: "Let's see, what else did I do? I ate, I slept, I went to the movies, I sent broken spine books to the bindery. I did everything I'd ever done before, but now each activity was surrounded by a fence, existed alone, and my life consisted of jumping from one fence to the next. There was no flow, for that had been Brenda." And that line just really jumps out to me. It thrills me. It's a line that is so specifically in the character's voice, but it's also such confidence in the writer's part, right? The writer knows exactly what he's doing here and is confident enough to toss off this very casual, almost fourth wall breaking line that stays in the writer's, in the character's voice, but jumps right out to the reader as like, I'm doing something very different here. It's like almost meta, like experimental fiction in like a very small, short phrase. And the idea of having that much confidence and security in your craft to drop that into your first novel to me is breathtaking.
Is this his first novel? I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's not a line that's a reference. It's not a line that is explicitly poetic or expressive, right? But in not being those things, it is poetic. It sort of has that resonance because it's so much not of the author. It's not self-conscious, right? It's not trying to show off. It's not trying to be something. It just is something. And it's not, it's so different than what I see in a lot of contemporary literature, which is interiority in a sort of self-conscious way, trying to make the inner monologue into something beautiful or something, you know, artistic, whereas often the inner monologue is just dumb thoughts like, what else did I do? It's very plain, and that plainness is what excites me.
There's a lot of writers in this era, I feel the same way about Updike, where they're not effortless, but they feel They feel that way. Like, and it's hard to sort of see until you see it in the absence, right? Where you don't necessarily, at least I don't, it just melts away when I read books by authors like this. You don't notice it until you read someone else trying to do it and failing. And then you're like, okay, you know, like there's probably a whole episode at some point where we can talk about how modern books are just obsessed with interiorities. But they don't usually do them well. At least I don't feel they do, because, you know, so much of it is just, here's what I'm thinking, and it doesn't work. And then lines like that are just, they seem so effortless. Wow, that's a hard word. Effortless. And they do, you learn more about a character in a line or two than you do in a paragraph of someone trying to do internal exposition.
Snowell also moves very quickly, right? The pace is pretty fast. On this read-through, I noticed that especially how the first chapter is only like 9 pages or so, and you get everything set up in that one chapter, and they're already making out, they're off to the races. There's no dithering or waiting around. I feel like most novels, you would, you know, chapter 3 before the characters even kissed, and in this novel they're getting to it really quickly, which is really exciting. There's not that kind of like dawdling around on the edges. It's just plot, and then let's get going and deal with the characters.
How did you guys read the title? It's the title. I thought it was kind of strange the way, so it's like Brenda's brother, right, is the one who has the record from his last football game in college, and like just listens to it over and over. And the thing that the announcer says when he scores, I think, is "Goodbye, Columbus, goodbye."
Yeah, it's a record that you get with the yearbook, right? It's like a retrospective record that sort of covers, you know, the big game and Ron's basketball game, but also some events on campus or some reference to like religious observation month or week or some weird shit like that. But the "Goodbye Columbus" part then is "Goodbye to Columbus, Ohio." It's a goodbye to the campus and the city, as if, you know, it's like an alumni sort of message. Like, you know, we'll leave here, but we'll return someday and taking good memories with us. It's "Goodbye," that version of Columbus.
I think it's actually a pretty good title. Ron is just like the stand-in for those expectations, right? He's the jock. He does what's asked. He goes to college. He works for the family. He does the thing. So that's just emblematic of the expectations. And again, I think it's about Brenda. So, you know, she's saying goodbye, right? And that's, it's fitting.
Yeah, I had the same thought, and I did some digging last night on Wikipedia and found that "Goodbye Columbus" was also a reference to a Yiddish theater song, I believe, called "Goodbye Columbus," and in which the reference there is "Goodbye to Christopher Columbus." It's a rejection of America. The character is rejecting assimilation into American culture and American identity, and representing that through rejecting Columbus, which means something different now, I guess, or in kind of modern mindset, but at the time would have been like saying goodbye George Washington, essentially. So it sort of has those dual meanings there.
Yeah. Before we wrap up, we should probably mention at least once their Jewishness and how that plays into the ideas of assimilation.
Yeah, I think we see that in the families and the way they're represented, Aunt Gladys and her dialect versus the sort of more polished prose or dialect of Mrs. Potemkin. You even see it in the Potemkin family. The father, in the letter he writes, it's a bit, you know, less sort of formal in terms of the writing, so just more working class background, whereas Mrs. Potemkin's letter is sort of suggests like finishing school, kind of polish, that kind of thing. So the dichotomy there is even built into the families. It's really explicit. Well, listeners, tell us what you thought about Philip Ross' "Goodbye Columbus." Find us on Twitter at YakBabies and email us at yakbabiespodcast@gmail.com and share your thoughts with us there. That'd be great. We'd love to hear what you have to say about this book, which is, like I said, one of my favorites. Also, patreon.com/yakbabies. Lots of content there for $1. You can get access to all our Patreon goodies. There's games, there's fun there. So check that out.
I've got an EME coming up that is called Roth, Moth, or Sloth. Get excited.
Until then, Yak Babies, yakking off.
The Yak Babies would like to thank all their loyal listeners and especially their patrons past and present, including Michael, Bonnie, Sebastian, David, and William Howard Taft.